Cool, thanks.
Yeah, the quality is pretty good on that. So one of the things I remember, the last time I was in Portland, I think it was like right around the time like Moe Shai came out. It was like...
I think I was recording.
Was there? Yeah, so I remember you had like a listening party that I couldn't get to.
Right.
Yeah, it was, so that would have been like maybe like December 13 or January 14, somewhere in that.
Yep.
You're right.
Yeah. You're right.
And so I remember I met with Steve Wax I always found them, who's his partner? Steve, it was another Steve, right? Steve Wax.
Steve Sadie.
And they were both like really, at the time, like resistant to say much. Like that he'd been convicted at that point. They were working on the appeal, I think. And I was really interested in like the FISA angle, and you know, and like it seems like one of my theories on the FISA, the way they're using FISA is that it's like parallel construction, right? They're using bulk collection of NSA data to target people, which would be illegal, and then they're manufacturing the predicate in some way, right? And it seems like it possibly did that in both cases, but like Wax and Sadie just like didn't want to talk about it, you know, and I didn't know if it was just like they didn't agree with the thesis, or if they were kind of trying to build a case and like couldn't get anywhere with it, kind of thing.
I don't know. I thought maybe they were concerned about sentencing. You know, their first duty is to get a license.
Yeah.
And if they said something, the judge
yeah.
said, like, antagonistic.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Did you meet with the woman's name who was also on the team?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think it was just the two Steves that were there when I met with them.
I can't remember her name. Doesn't matter. So that leads to the question, you know, why did they interview Mo after that date rape charge, I guess.
Right, right.
The FBI just showed up and was kind of dismissed.
Right.
And the next day the FBI was there, so somehow he must have been on some list.
Yeah, they had reason to, right. If he was targeted as a result of bulk collection, like they identified him because of some email contact that he had, right? And there was this shady story about how he was apparently like emailing someone in Pakistan, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they never really provided a lot of information on that. So, I mean, the government might say like, well, look, the funny thing is that this issue is coming up now in this like, the FBI hearing yesterday with the unmasking of Mike Flynn in those calls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was that the Republicans are now mad about this, right? But, you know, a couple of years ago they couldn't have cared less. But the idea with Mike Flynn was that the way that incidental collection works is, like, they target, like, a foreign operative. And in this case, it might have been some terrorist in Pakistan, right? And so under the law, it's supposed to mitigate all of the information about U.S. citizens. So if a U.S. citizen contacts that person, intelligence agencies are supposed to get the information of the U.S. person, or sorry, the non-U.S. person has. So any communications, he said, but then any information that of the U.S. person talking or communicating by writing is supposed to be mitigated, right? So it's not supposed to be there. And then you need like special authorization at DOJ to unmask that person. And so that's probably what happened with Flynn, right? And so presumably that could have been what happened with Muhammad, right? Like that he was communicating with someone who was under a legitimate FISA warrant, right? And then they unmasked him, and then they're like, okay, let's target this guy.
Right.
But they can't use that as justification, so then they found these other ways, right?
Right.
And so maybe he's on that watch list, and they hear about this incident in Oregon, or like that was a big setup, right? Like that the girl who accused him of rape was like some kind of operative, right? And then that gives them access to his phone, right? Because they took like a full copy of his phone and his computer. So we went when I was there in January 14. We went to like the Corvallis was university, right? And we tried to get any kind of records from the police, and they really kind of stonewalled all this at the time. But it was really suspicious, right? Like, and that the police would so readily cooperate with the federal government. You know, like the FBI shows up, like, and they could say because they're campus police and they were impressed that the FBI was there, but they didn't have to give the FBI access like that, right? It's just weird that they did, you know? It's like, maybe it was just kind of bigfooting them, be like, oh, the FBI is in town, this guy must be dangerous. But like that girl is sensitive, right? Like I don't want to be one of these guys that accuses women of like crying rape, right? But at the same time, like that girl has never, no one knows who that girl is, right? Like,
and there's no evidence of date rape, drugs or whatever.
Right, right.
Well, then she must have submitted to that test, or they must have known that result was coming, if that's the case. Still, it doesn't prove or disprove.
I can't remember, did they do like a rape kit on her? Like, was it, like she woke up the next day and said she was drunk, right? Was that what it was? And that he knew she was incapacitated?
Yes.
Okay.
And they tested for whatever standard date rape drugs and nothing.
Right, right. Okay, that's right. She accused him of drugging her.
Right.
Okay. And then no charges were brought,
charges were brought. He did give them permission to look at his laptop and cell phone.
Right. And then they gave it back and he used it, right? So who knows what they put on it, right?
Who knows what they put on it. Yeah, maybe I could just go through kind of my discovery phase during the trial. So at the second or third day of the trial, they were playing some undercover case. And I thought it was very clear to me that Muhammad was stoned, that he was getting weed.
Right.
And I was wondering if the FBI was giving it to them.
Yeah.
And at one point, Muhammad's sitting on the floor surrounded by takeout food. The two agents are sitting in chairs. And he says, "Got anything to burn?" And Hussein says, "By all means, please do." And the prosecutor said they were talking about burning evidence. However, to my ear, that's drug talk. "By all means, please do. Got anything to burn?" That to me is clear.
Right.
Is there direct evidence of the FBI providing drugs to targets?
I've never heard of that if they did. I'm sure they wouldn't want. I mean, that. And Max and Sadie didn't pursue that as like a... I mean, because I mean, that would be a classic kind of entrapment evidence that, like, hey, we got this guy stoned so we could, you know, manipulate him into moving forward.
I was sure that it was going to come out.
Yeah.
And when it became clear they were calling our last witnesses, I said, it's not going to come out. So I told Lex during the trial.
Yeah.
And he told me the next day indeed that was in there and referred to burning evidence.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with your suspicion. I mean, it just seemed like, why would... Yeah, I mean, getting anything to burn, about to please do, that strikes me as more of like a conversation about smoking weed than anything,
And he reached around to his back pocket sitting on the floor and put two fingers in his back left pocket, and that's where the video cut out. So he's probably even paying for it, possibly. I don't know. He's like, he was posing as a drug dealer and weapons dealer.
Right, yeah.
Just as a way to keep him, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing definitive there. It's just...
I don't remember, did Muhammad, like, was he a regular...
Regular.
He
was. All throughout the trial.
Really?
He was trying to find weed the whole time.
Okay.
He was always looking for it. And he seemed to have a different personality sometimes, too. I didn't always see direct evidence of him smoking up, but sometimes he was kind of a somber, religious person, and sometimes he was just goofy off the walls.
Suggesting he was high at those times?
Suggesting he was high.
Yeah.
The test bomb case, for example, they were out up at a Corvallis somewhere, and the bomb goes off, and Muhammad says, "Oh, Yusuf, I didn't know he had so much white hair," and kind of messes with his head.
Huh.
And Yusuf's like, "Hiccup."
Right.
Oh, man. But really, throughout the trial, and I think it came out in the government evidence as well, that he's always looking for weed. I scored a dub, for example. I didn't know what a dub was at the time, but now I guess it's, I don't know where it is. 20-pack, I think. And then there were things that seemed incredulous, sort of beyond what I've heard in other cases. You know, the first example is there's a statement by the government agent, "We're using everything we have on it." But they never talk about weed or sex. And, you know, given that he's always looking for weed, that's obvious.
Right.
And that he's got this charge possibly hanging over him, or history.
Right.
And he's an 18-year-old kid. You know,
right.
Sex is the obvious thing.
Right.
Is there any evidence in your experience of using sex on a target in a way or something like that?
Trying to think. I mean, there have been, like... Yeah, I mean, there's the Eric McDavid case. Are you familiar with that one? So Eric McDavid was one of these guys who was a supposed eco-terrorist, and there was this young informant named Anna, and they So he ended up getting convicted at trial, and he had made all these claims that Anna, you know, was seducing him, and they could never prove it, right? And so he had these advocates who filed all these FOIA requests on his behalf, and either, you know, either someone in the government was doing their job, or and like realized this was a kind of an injustice and provided it, or provided a mistake. But then they provided all these reports that showed that the government had used the FBI had used the psychological evaluation unit to figure out how best to manipulate him using, like, you know, the femme fatale sex as a lure. And that's the main one I can think of where they did use that. You know, and certainly, like, the use of, like, in a counterintelligence perspective, like, the use of women is pretty common, you know? So I can't think of any kind of stings necessarily that use that, other than kind of, like, the vague, like, exactly. Hey, you'll be all these virgins,
yeah,
in martyrdom, right, kind of thing, you know?
Right. Right. When they were going to the test bomb site outside of Corvallis, the FBI agent reported on the stand they got lost for like 2 hours each way, and they had a talking GPS system going.
And they still got lost?
Both ways, about 2 hours each way.
Why would that happen,
you think? Yeah, now I'm going through the things that I think are glaring.
Yeah.
Something is not right there. Something happened there significantly. That is significant.
Oh, I see. So there's 2 hours that are missing. That something we don't know what happened, is that what you mean?
Right. And their excuse was, we got lost for like 2 hours each way.
Even though they had GPS.
You hear it in the background of the undercover tapes. Turn right at blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. And even if you got, I mean...
Both ways.
Yeah. I mean, what is it? Like, it's only like an hour and 45 minutes maybe from Corvallis to Portland, if that?
It wasn't in Portland. It was a test bomb site somewhere.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact
distance. I mean, 2 hours, you drive a long way. You know, who gets lost that long, right? Like...
And there are, you know, hundreds of other, not hundreds, but dozens of other agents going to the site to set everything up.
Right.
It's just impossible that happened in my mind. Yeah, I guess I'll just go through these things.
Yeah.
Then I'll put out my theory, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
Another thing that I thought was impossible was... at the day of the at the arrest scene. Well, first, of course, they go through the thing. They try to make him have a big reaction, I think. The agent first testifies on the stand. He was yelling and screaming, and then the defense, I think it was Hay, was the woman. I don't remember her first
name. You worked with Sadie and Mike.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Hay. So Ms. Hay asks, well, did you grab him in the groin? And he says, I performed a type 3 or high security search. Which means, I guess, that.
With some force, I guess?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's court sort of the stuff that's not pointing to what I'm getting at. But And then the next thing was, Muhammad was quiet after that. He's just a shy, quiet kid.
Yeah.
He's not going to do anything. He's sitting in the car with Agent Trusis, I think his name was, who was the bathroom guy, I guess, putting things together. And another agent. The other agent said... reported, I don't know if it was in court or in a paper filing, that Trusis said something to Muhammad in Arabic, and Muhammad kicked out. Trusis said, he kicked me in the head a couple times. Yeah.
That's weird.
Yes. And on the stand, I can't remember who it was that was questioning Trusis, asked him, what did you say to him? And he said, I don't remember. I think I said, be quiet. And then the defense attorney asked, he testified that he was already quiet. What did you say to him in Arabic? I think I said be quiet. So clearly not right. There's something hidden there, I believe.
Right. Do you think he really kicked him?
Possibly. Or I think he struck out. And he said something very provocative.
I see, because he said something provocative in Arabic that would have caused him to lash out like that.
So the other FBI witness knew he said something, and he doesn't know what he said. But and Trusis cannot say I didn't say anything.
Was Mo fluent in Arabic?
No.
Okay, so it would have been something more textually based, right? Like from the Quran or something, I would guess, right?
Maybe. I think he knew some Arabic. It was who said that the two agents spoke in front of him in Arabic. If they spoke quickly or something, he wouldn't pick it up.
I see. Okay.
Maybe if he spoke slowly, he would understand it or use certain dialects or something.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly. Another thing that I thought didn't fit in at all was in the closing arguments, the prosecutor showed the white van, the famous white van, from the back side, which was a new piece of evidence. During the trial, they showed Mohammed looking inside of the side of the van, but the back door is closed.
Okay.
And he had this expression on his face, and that's where he said it's beautiful.
Right, right.
In the closing arguments, they showed a picture of the van open with the bomb apparatus inside of it. And that, to me, is an unphysical picture. It's the middle of the day, and it's in the middle of Portland, and they're not going to have the doors open at that time.
Right, right. So you think that the note was taken after? I mean, what do you think is suspicious about that the picture?
I think it's unphysical. It's unlikely that is an actual picture. It's an actual photograph because you're not going to open the van and display the bomb in the middle of the day. During the trial, they showed almost the same shot with the back doors closed. He wanted to establish Mohammed looking in at the bomb.
Right, right.
And during the trial, they showed that same picture with the doors closed and Mohammed was just, oh my God.
Right, okay.
Okay, still going through it. On the drive, did you know that Mohammed didn't have his driver's license?
I didn't know.
He came out in the trial for halfway through.
Did he never have it?
He never had it.
Really?
You know, he's just driving, I think he was trying to get out of it in a way. He said, you know, I don't have my driver's license. And he's talking to Yusuf. And he said, oh, geez, that might be a problem. I have to check with that. Hussein drove him to the site. I think in your book you have that both Asians drove him, and that's not how it was reported.
Oh, really? Just one of them drove him.
Hussein. And Muhammad was the passenger. So
I imagine I would have gotten that from the affidavit, unless they reported it wrong. Or I could have gotten it wrong.
Suspicion is that was the plan.
That both of them drove.
That was the plan.
Right.
And the reality was no.
Yeah.
Something changed.
Right.
And this is why he's, getting suspicious.
Right, right.
So Hussein is driving him, and he says, smell that diesel. Don't you love that diesel smell? And Muhammad's just blabbing about something else. And he said it a few times. Don't you love that diesel smell? Smell that diesel. Don't you love the diesel smell? On the stand, I can't remember again. I think it's Sadie questioning him. It may have been Wax. What did you say about the smell? Well, what does it smell like in the car? And he said, I don't remember. It was gas or something, diesel, I don't know.
Yeah.
And he reviews, obviously he said on the stand that he reviewed notes and he reviewed the whole case. So the fact that he was adamant about the diesel smell in the car and prevaricated on the stand made me suspicious.
Right.
Whew. On the day of the event, things stuck out. Mohammed was just relaxed to the point of indifference. They were driving to the site and said, oh, look, this is my mom's car. And the agent freaks out. And Mohammed's like, there's my mom's car.
Yeah, well, I remember the prosecution made a big deal about how, like, as he's delivering the bomb, he sees his mother or something, right? Is that what that was?
It was never clear to me whether it was her type of car or...
Or what type of her car.
Or thought it was her. Or thought it was her car.
I see. Okay, okay. I thought the prosecutors tried to suggest that they were driving the bomb and, like, sees his mother walking by or something. And, and maybe it was something that the FBI told the public, or I just might be misremembering it.
Yeah.
It was something like that, just to show how his cold-bloodedness, right?
Exactly.
He killed his own mother.
After he dialed the cell phone once, he sort of said, I think I should try again.
Yeah.
And it didn't fit.
Right.
It just didn't fit. There's no video of Mohammed arming the device. It seems like that would be pretty critical evidence.
Right.
The audio of that.
And
I don't know. I don't know why they
would. Especially since it's an FBI van, if they could have even put it in the camera.
180 all over.
Right.
And then what we talked about, it seemed like they changed the plan where only Hussein would drive him and Yusuf. They'd pick up Yusuf somewhere else or something like that.
It
seemed like they had negative operational value.
Right.
I feel like something changed there.
Yeah.
And only a few people know about that changed. So then, to put it quickly, to come to a quick end, what I think makes a lot more sense is that Muhammad indeed backed out. He decided for option three, raise money, and to raise money, he was going to make a big drug deal. And diesel is sour diesel marijuana. The van that he looked at was full of weed. He was driven there, stoned out of his mind, thinking he's making a big weed deal, and he's going to get to where they promised to take him, wherever, Arabia or Yemen, wherever they promised to take him. He doesn't have to blow people up anymore. He only has to make his drug deal. That's the crux of it.
And diesel is slang for weed?
I didn't know it at the time. There's a brand called Sour Diesel.
Okay. And so he's like, I see. Well, that diesel fuel or gas is not a, like, particularly nice smell. So it's one of the things, like, you wouldn't be like, smell that diesel, right? It is kind of a weird thing to say, you know?
All of it was just weed talk.
Today. Right.
Just weed talk. Oh, yeah, smell that. When he was looking in the van, you know, you don't know for sure, but either he's a monster or, you know, he's got these happy face on, like, holy crap, man.
Right. Well, what about, I mean, how, with that, in that theory, how do you explain the phone call to detonate the bomb?
Yeah, there are two things that I don't really know or have what was he doing to arm the bomb, and what did he think he was doing when he was phoning it?
Right.
And for both of them, I can just say, you know, whatever the agents wanted him to do.
Right.
And I think that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was setting up a deal, you know, maybe he was trying to make a camera or maybe they did a small elaborate plan, well, if they don't show up with the dough, we're going to do XYZ or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, although I don't know. I don't know any of this, but I'm just saying I believe this story is a lot more plausible than, you know, what the prosecutor presented on opening statement, that he just needed a little help getting things together, and he was committed to jihad, violent jihad, since he was 15.
Right. Have you spoken to him?
Mom?
Yeah.
I wrote him once in jail. I didn't hear back.
He didn't write? Okay. I think I tried to write him, too, and I don't think I had any luck.
Yeah, so then to round out that theory, on the 2 hours each way, they took him somewhere where he did something where he could get in trouble for. For example, sex with a minor.
He said, like, blackmail?
Blackmail.
Yeah.
And that's what Truce said to him, to provoke him. And, they, even given his cultural history, if it was homosexual sex or something like that, that would be something he would not admit. He would rather go to jail.
Especially
if he's going to go to jail for this other thing or go to jail for this thing. In my mind, he would stay quiet.
Right. But he's already been, do you have any reason to suggest that, like, his sexual proclivities would be, like, a minor or anything like that? He'd already been kind of, through the rape charge, exposed to his parents and his friends as having had premarital sex, right?
True.
So like a religious extremist, you know, that would be kind of a black eye, I guess.
True. Well, when I thought of writing a fictionalized version, the sort of the punchline was, she said it was her finger. And then the men say, yeah, now we know we can trust you. We have to do that too. Now we know we can trust you. That's your final test.
Yeah.
Because all throughout the trial, you know, besides the usual, you can get out now stuff that we hear all the time, there was the question, how do we know we can trust you?
Right.
So 2 hours each way, you know, my guess is maybe one way was I thought it was her finger, and the other way was, can it be a real girl this time?
Right.
We're laughing, and yet it's deadly serious. And, it was supposed to be kind of humorous when I was writing this second script.
Has anyone, in the trial, they didn't explore at all, like, these 2 hours of apparently being lost, right?
Well, they knocked on that door, and eventually the judge says, move on.
Right.
That's an answer.
Right.
Anyway, I think that's about all I've got to lay out for you. And again, I don't claim that it's true in any detail. My claim is it's a lot more plausible than the FBI's story. story.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree. The FBI story is crazy. I mean, it's certainly possible. I didn't know about the 2 hours being lost. I mean, that seems really suspicious. Explain to me again. So I didn't quite understand what you meant by, I think you used the term, it was unphysical. Like, the picture of the van. So your working theory would be that he was in the van, and instead of seeing this bomb, he's seeing a bunch of marijuana, right? And so when he says that's beautiful, and that would make sense with that beautiful, right? Like, I don't know what kind of stuff, even a psychopath is like, with a bomb is not a beautiful thing, right? Like, but like a bunch of weed to a stoner or somebody that can make a lot of money, that's a beautiful thing, right? So that makes sense. But then like, the picture they showed in the closing arguments of the van open from behind, you think that's different somehow? Like, what did you mean by like it's unphysical? Like, why did you think that was a discrepancy from the picture of the side from the...
I don't think the van doors would be open in broad daylight on the day of the operation. It just doesn't seem to make sense to me that the back doors would be wide open. That's what I meant by unphysical. I don't think that happened. I think when he's looking in that van, the back doors are closed and it's full of weed.
I see. And did the government say when they took that photo? Like, was it after the operation?
Or they... It was in the morning while they were at the hotel. They were at a hotel, I think.
Okay. And so Muhammad wasn't there at that moment, and the agent opened up the back and took a picture, or apparently, or that you have to believe.
Or photoshopped.
I don't know.
I'm not sure. No, Muhammad was in that picture physically. It was just, I think, it was the same scene as when he said it's beautiful.
Right.
And I'm saying it's not possible that those doors were open during broad daylight. And he didn't show it during the trial. He saved it for the closing arguments. And I call that, you know, the lie he couldn't leave alone. He was, the prosecutor or whoever was so intent on, there is a bomb in there when he's looking.
Right.
They showed something that was impossible.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a good theory for the that's beautiful line, as well as like, would smell that gasoline or whatever they say, right? Who would say that?
Smell that diesel.
Diesel, I mean, yeah. I mean, no one would say that. It's crazy.
And the fact that he prevaricated on the stand after reviewing all the evidence getting ready for the trial.
Yeah.
I think really the key, you know, Hussein made a lot of mistakes during the trial, and he's kind of the weak link there.
Right.
He was brought in second when Youssef couldn't get him to go all the way on the first meeting or whatever was happening there. And it makes sense, you know, they're sort of psychologically profiling him.
Right.
They know he loves weed.
Right, yeah. Did they testify in disguise, the agent? Do you remember?
I don't think so. The reporters were out of the room, though.
Oh, they didn't kick reporters out. Okay.
So I think
you had to listen in.
We had to listen in. One time during undercover testimony, the tape continued on and we saw the faces of the agents.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Nigel Dura was covering it for AP, I think, and reported on what they looked like.
Oh, he did? Okay.
And the FBI called the AP and said, don't do that.
I see. Okay. Do you remember what they were? Were they like Middle Eastern looking guys?
Yeah. I don't remember in much detail.
Right.
No, you could be one of them.
I confess.
Yeah, maybe.
I have to deny you that because I'm Lebanese, yeah.
There were fair skin.
Right, yeah.
Arabic.
Yeah.
I guess maybe Moroccan or whatever.
Right.
I'm not sure.
So I guess I would say, like, so in kind of playing devil's advocate against the theory.
Please.
If that was the case, right, if they got him talking about how he wants to buy a bunch of marijuana, and he wants to use the money to support, you know, Al-Qaeda or whatever group he's interested in. I mean, that by itself is a conspiracy that they could have prosecuted him for, right? Like, they'd call that, like, narco-terrorism, you know, just be like, hey, you know, it's a stick. I mean, it wouldn't have a splashy headline to win the bomb at Christmas tree lighting ceremony, but, I mean, they could have said, well, he was in this conspiracy to buy from us, like, I don't know, 10 pounds of marijuana or whatever, and he was going to use the profits to fund terrorist attacks overseas, and we have all that on tape. You know, I mean, that they could have gotten him for something like that. And so, if they had him on that, And like, why go to the trouble to like manufacture a bomb plot?
Yeah. I think perhaps he backed out late.
Okay.
And he said all this great stuff.
Right.
And I think especially Yusuf is ambitious, and he's not going to take second place.
Right. So they had him talking about the bomb plot, and then he backs out, and so they bring in like the marijuana as like, hey, what about this? So, yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
But then, do you think why wouldn't he make a more, through his lawyers obviously, make a more vociferous defense that he wasn't a bomb, right? Like it was, I was buying weed. You know, I mean,
he's going to go to jail for something.
Yeah.
It's either raping that young boy in the hotel room outside of Corvallis.
Oh, I see.
Or taking his chances here.
And going to trial, yeah. But then he could have just, I mean, I guess, if that is the case, if he feels like he's going to be shamed because they got him on tape, like, having sex with an underage boy, or whatever the kind of, the leverage they have on him, then wouldn't he like have decided not to take this to trial? He'd be like, all right, let's plead it out. You know what I mean? I'll plead guilty to this charge. I don't want it coming out that I raped that boy or whatever he did. You know what I mean? Like, if that was the case, I guess I question why he would have chosen to take it to trial then.
He can still get off.
Yeah.
He still has a chance.
So you're thinking is that, so it was marijuana, but they had some kind of leverage point from the loss, or the loss of the 2 hours each way, right? And so his feeling is like, but then how would he know, though, that the government wouldn't introduce that as evidence, or that somehow it wouldn't come out that, yeah, he wanted to have sex with this boy, right? Like, I mean, I guess the government also implicit in that crime, then, if that happened, right?
The government doesn't want that. I mean, I can't say for sure. In any case, you know, I think Muhammad was kind of passive during the trial. He was just letting things go. He was he wasn't making any choices.
Yeah.
He was just keeping his head down and saying, now I believe in Allah. That's all I'm concerned about.
Right.
Whatever happens to me, I love Allah.
Yeah, it was an interesting theory. I mean, there's a lot that didn't add up about that case, you know, and certainly like the rape charge was among the early things that was just like, that doesn't make any sense. I don't know. And it'd be great, it'd be great if you could reach out to him, someone exchange letters with him, get him to explain that maybe he's so ashamed about all this, he wouldn't want to, right? And at that point, I remember like we did interview a couple of people. Nothing ever came out. We didn't do any stories on it, but like we interviewed a couple of people who like knew him in college and were his friends, like from the local Somali community. And like one of the things they described was just like how he kind of like socially withdrawn. And I get that during this time, the people that were his friends like didn't really see him much, and they didn't know what was going on, but there was a lot that didn't fit with his personality. Like there was a lot that didn't fit with the government's description of him as this kind of religious zealot, right? Like it didn't make sense that some like religious zealot would go to some fraternity party, get drunk, and hook up with a girl for like a one night stand, right? Like this doesn't fit the profile at all.
He's always looking for weed. I scored a dub in a pint of vodka or something. It's not an uncommon email that we saw from Muhammad.
Really? Okay. Was that in the evidence?
In the evidence.
Okay.
That's provided by the defense to say he's not a zealot in any sense of the word.
Right.
He's conflicted.
Right.
That part was clear. And he's conflicted to the extent where, you know, I saw two personalities watching the trial and listening to the tapes. There's the kind of serious kid and the guy who's stoned the whole time.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to decide anything today. Let me just check my notes here.
Let me see. Remember, I've been trying hard to get the transcripts for as many of these cases as I could. I think that's one I got.
Oh, good for you. I'm glad to hear that.
Do you have them by chance?
No.
I'm happy to share them with you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Did you have to pay for them, or?
No, I usually try not to if I can't, because they're so expensive. So yeah. I usually try to get it from the attorney. Can't remember if this is all I have. I'm going to search for it later.
Sure. Yeah. No hurry there.
Yeah. But then I was thinking, let me see what I have. Yeah, let's take a few. I'll send them to you.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just send you this. There were some interesting filings that Sandy and Wax made about. Like the FISA evidence and the FISA filing, and it was always my theory, like as to the that's how like they originally got to him, and so that would have predated like the rape incident, right? And so like if they would have like found him out like through his bulk surveillance, which isn't illegal, then they're like watching him, and then so then how do you explain like this average college kid, right? Like gets involved in this rape allegation, right? And the next day, like, the FBI is there. It's not like the local cops would have called the FBI for something like that, right? So how does the FBI know to go there? Unless, like, A, they're, like, surveilling him, or B, like, the woman who was raped was somehow working with the FBI, right? Or quote-unquote raped. But you can, how do you prove that, right? And so then they get his phone, and then after they get his phone, is when he starts getting the emails, I think, right? Remember how, like, he gets the emails? So if I'm remembering right, he has, the government alleged that their predicate was based on him, let me see, I think I have a complaint. The government alleged that his predicate was based on, okay, the court authorized surveillance obtained during this investigation showed that in August 2009, Muhammad was in email contact with unindicted associate 1. And they basically say that he was located in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan, right? And so that happens after the rape investigation in Portland, right? So if you're to believe the government, the government only discovered this in August 2009 based on a court order of FISA, right? So they found something to justify the order that gets them this guy, right? But then how do they, if they don't have that, how would they know to be in Corvallis? Like, there was something going on, right? Like, so the government had targeted him before they're admitting to the court that they had predicate, which I don't know how to explain that. Right? It's our cat while he's saying hello. Hope you're not allergic.
Oh, no. Over the screen.
He's shy.
Yeah, it's good to be cautious.
So there is so much about the case that doesn't add up. I guess, like, it's weird that Sadie or Wax, like, wouldn't pursue. Maybe they have, I don't know, like that. They've never been cooperative with me in kind of trying to, you know, figure some of these things out, right? So I assume they haven't been with others either. But they're good lawyers, so it seems strange that, like, I don't know, like they knew something we don't in that sense, you know? Like,
yeah, I don't know. I'm glad you focused on the FISA part. It's something that I haven't wrapped my head around, but I'm focused on.
Yeah, the FISA part. I think you've got some interesting theories too, because there's so much of it that didn't make sense.
There's one more thing I kind of hesitate to say, because my view of it was just so brief. This is when I think Hussein is on the stand, so the reporters are in a different room watching on a monitor. I've already mentioned that there's a few mistakes with the video. One of them was we saw both agents' face.
Yes.
In that scene where Mohammed is looking inside of the van, Hussein is wearing a camera. This is where Mohammed says, beautiful. At the very end of that video, the camera swings around the van, and I felt confident I saw something green in there. I was already thinking about weed at this point, so I said, well, maybe the carpeting is green or something like that.
Right, right.
When they finally showed it, it was 2x4s and blue barrels. And I can't swear I saw green. However, when the camera swung around, I thought it showed the inside of the van with green. I didn't identify it as weed because it was so quick.
Yeah.
I can't really say with confidence that it was green.
Right.
However, I did note that in my handwritten court notes that his camera swung around to green. I was very anxious to say, well, when I see the inside of that van, I want to look for, you know, green.
Yeah.
Upholstery
or
something.
So then the barrel, was that supposed to be like gasoline to the bomb? Is that the thing? Okay. And then like diesel as pot, is that like a very expensive, is that like a special kind
solid
of
pot? Solid diesel is good, it's good weed.
Good weed, okay. So it probably would be like on the higher end of a price, right, if you went to resell it.
That's why it's beautiful.
Okay.
That's why, don't you love that? Don't you love that diesel smell? Don't you love that diesel smell? And Muhammad didn't even react to that. He was blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I mean, I always kind of read that, don't you love that diesel smell, as like trying to elicit like a psychopathic response. Like, don't you love the smell of death in the morning kind of thing, right? That's how I always kind of figured it. Or napalm in the morning, right?
Yeah. It's just as, you know, kind of thing to burn, by all means, please do, is weed talk. I thought I heard that as weed talk. Man, smell that.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Yo.
Yeah.
And there's no proof there. No proof, nothing I said.
Did any, I can keyword search, did marijuana ever come up in a trial at all? I mean, I can keyword search the...
It sure did in his emails that the defense presented. He was a conflicted, confused kid. Look, he's using weed all the time, and he thinks he ought to be religious. So that's their evidence that he's a confused, conflicted kid.
So you knew he was deeply involved in alcohol use of marijuana, and partying.
Exactly.
Right. He was involved in using marijuana, yeah. And smoking marijuana, yeah. Yeah. Did you have information on occasion Mr. Muhammad might give some marijuana or sell a small marijuana to his friend? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why I was sure they were going to take this marijuana angle home. And when they didn't, man, I was surprised. And eventually talked to me. Kind of a funny story. When I was talking to Wax, I don't know how the hell it happened, but I didn't know where to do it. Agents were all over the place, so he went into the restroom. We were in the restroom at the same time. And I think I wrote Pete, and I kind of started trying to talk to him. And he just... kind of put up his hand and we just rushed to exit the restroom, which is where I told him in the hallway. And the following day, he was very kind to me. The following day, he called me over to the bar or whatever and said...
This is Wax or Sadie?
Wax. Called me over to the bar and says, yes, it refers to burning evidence.
Huh. That's an error.
I got one more thing. It's the, just one time, it's, again, nothing, no smoking gun. one of the videos, Hussein and Muhammad stand up off the floor, and Hussein offers on the stand without even questioning, oh yeah, we were praying, and you know, my suspicion is we were in bong hits, again, nothing.
We went to show a picture of them, like,
coming up.
Crouching. Yeah. I see, okay. Both at the same time?
I can't say for sure, and again, it's just a small piece, but just that he would kind of blurt that out without even being asked.
Just to cover it up.
Or we were praying, like there's something going on there. It just made a little hair on my neck go up.
What was the phrase again? Do you have something to burn? Or was it?
Got anything to burn is how I remember it. By all means, please do. It was in the very end, one of the videos they showed, I think with Hussein on the stand. It was Hussein who said, by all means, please do in any case.
Doesn't comes up under burn. You know, this one time it brings up they mentioned Burnside.
Yeah. Again, it's at the very end of the tape, and you know.
They were only getting the transcripts of someone on the stand, like Rakita, as the issue.
Oh, I see.
So if it was like they just played the tape, it wouldn't be reflected in the transcript.
Is there a way to get those tapes?
Yeah. At this point, they're probably FOIA-able. We could also, Sadie and Wax, like, if they're feeling generous, could share them, but it might be worth, you know, contacting them.
Yeah.
Trying to think the only other way, yeah. Like, during the day of the trial, you should have been able to go to the court clerk and get copies if the judge wasn't prohibiting it, but sometimes they're not always efficient in that way. But now that the case is closed, you can probably FOIA it from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oregon. That's probably the best way to do it.
Good.
You might even call it the press office and get them to release it that way.
And likewise for any photos or whatever were shown.
Yeah, you'd have to say any exhibits provided to the court. And, I mean, I don't think that trial, it was an open court, so, you know, the evidence shouldn't be under any sort of exclusion, yeah.
Good. I know we're kind of running out of time. I sort of had this idea I might interview you about sort of the more broader case, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So in the Muhammad case, there was this idea of getting the green light from somewhere at the FBI. Is it common in a lot of cases, the idea of a green light, like all of a sudden, yeah, go?
Yeah, so they have this thing called the Undercover Review Committee. And so like any time an operation like that would be going on, they have to go to Washington to get the operation approved. So any kind of undercover terrorism sting needs to go to the Undercover Review Committee for approval. So they would have required that green light. And then it can be particularly onerous if the approval or if the case involves like sensitive, what they call sensitive investigative matters, like journalists. Since Muhammad was out of school, they might have required approval to like surveil him while he's on campus, you know, that kind of thing. So the green light is probably it could be referring to like a local approval, but more likely it's referring to kind of Washington approving it.
Right. My suspicion was that the green light corresponded with provable predisposition, and that plus push the button is all they need. Anything in between is irrelevant. Does that make any sense or fit in?
I was assuming that they said the green light kind of early in the case. Is that not?
Yes.
They would have needed predicate, at least a kind of a formal predicate, even if they were manufacturing it, to go to the Undercover Review Committee and say, okay, hey, we want to do this operation. And then I would think it would be based on having the predicate and then kind of having the investigation start. Because then once the investigation is approved, then they have a budget to work it.
Right. I guess I was thinking in terms of an eventual conviction. Is there a bar that says, okay, if he wrote for Jihad Recollections, yes, we've got predisposition. Now, if we can only get him to push the button, that's all we need, because that's all they needed.
Yeah, so those conversations usually happen like with the local U.S. Attorney's Office as the investigation is ongoing. So, like, I suspect, like, I would guess that a green light would have been like, okay, undercover review committee says this is okay to investigate, right? But we don't know if we have enough to bring charges. And then once that's approved, then at that point the conversation moves from the FBI in Washington to the local U.S. Attorney's Office and whoever the prosecutor is, and then they would have conversations about, like, do we have enough to go on kind of thing.
I see. Is he pushed the button twice common?
Yeah, that's always the case. And I think that's to show that they're committed to doing it, right? Like, it's almost, they two is usually the minimum. In some cases, there's three or four times that they try to call it, you know? And I think that's just to show that they're, it plays better for a jury, right? Like, you didn't do it once and it didn't go off and he's like, shit, I don't want to do this now. It's more like, look, he's like a hard, you know, court killer. He tried and failed and then tried again.
I think in your book you say the Portland case is most egregious in some ways.
Did I say that about Portland? It's the Liberty City case is definitely among the most egregious.
There were two of them, I guess.
Yeah.
About at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, Portland was definitely egregious in the way that he was manipulated, right? And, you know, it was egregious in the way that they confiscated his phone during the rape allegation. I mean, there were definitely a lot of questions about it. You know, and definitely, like, he had, like, no capacity, right? Like, there's no way he was going to, like, bomb anything. So I think that was part of it. And then the other, you know, the other thing that was interesting about Portland is, like, it really was kind of outsized in its influence nationally. Like, it got a lot of attention compared to kind of fairly comparable cases, right? Like, there was that case in Dallas involving Hossam Smadi, who was, it was very similar. Like, he was going to bomb Fountain Place, which is, like, the highest skyscraper in Dallas. And, you know, so it would have killed essentially thousands of people, right? And like, that really just made, like, regional news in Texas. And for whatever reason, like, the, I don't know if it was because of the Christmas tree ceremony or what, or maybe because it was in Portland, who knows. It just got, like, made national news, you know. It was a really crazy, outsized case in that way. You know, and in some ways it continued to be because he took it to trial and whereas a lot of these guys, you know, plead guilty.
Yeah, that golden name.
Yeah, it's true. Not just Muhammad, but Muhammad.
Do you know much about the training for FBI agents to testify?
Not a lot of training. I mean, so there's a couple. I mean, the main thing I know about it is what they call it, giglio, which is giglio is when if you're giglioed as an agent, and there was a recent study that said as many as a third are giglioed, which means that you did something in your past that, like, is a credibility issue. And so, like, oftentimes giglioed agents will work cases, but they'll never testify because of credibility issues. You know, I mean, agents go through training in the sense that, like, answer questions only to, like, their specificity, like yes, no, but not, you know, I don't know more than that if they are kind of training them. They do, like any defendants, they will often, like, pre-game it with the prosecutors, right? Like, with just, and defendants do that with their lawyers, too. Like, here's what you'll be likely to ask. And I know they do that kind of stuff. So there will be a certain amount of coaching by the U.S. Attorney's Office.
I think I remember reading that the FBI had contact with the two kids in Boston.
Is that our name?
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, at least, I think the only one that's been confirmed is Tomlin, the older one. So Tomlin was, like, the backstory of that was that the Russian government had contacted them and said that he was contacted the FBI in Boston and said that Tomlin was communicating with these Chechen extremists and that we think he's dangerous. And the FBI did an assessment where they investigated him for the 72-hour period and they interviewed him. And shortly after that, he travels to Chechnya and then comes back. And there was the FBI's kind of public statement on this has been that they determined that he wasn't a threat and kind of closed it from there. I mean, there have been people that have theorized that, like, it was actually, he was recruited as an informant and, you know, who knows? I mean, none of that's ever really been confirmed. I mean, it is fairly suspicious that, like, the Russian government would be like, hey, you should check this guy out. And then they would just be like, oh, he's fine, right? But, you know, to the FBI's credit, like, maybe they thought that this was some, like, weird counterintelligence thing the Russians were doing. Like, they were sending them down a rabbit hole and they reviewed it. They crossed it off. But, I mean, I've always been suspicious of it because it seems to me like a foreign government, particularly one with an intelligence service as sophisticated as the Russians, probably would be worth like being like, hey, maybe there's something there, especially compared to the fact that like they'll often like take the word of some drug addicted informant, right? Like that someone's a danger, you know. So.
I guess different FBI regional FBI agents have different policies. However, the report came on Muhammad, he would be an impediment to any operation whatsoever, and they had dozens of agents on him 24/7.
Right, yeah. It doesn't make sense they would have. And that's what it was like. I mean, we don't really even know like what the FISA evidence was, like what it communicated. So maybe they had reason to believe, you know, I mean, he did write for Jihad Recollections, but I mean, that doesn't mean anything. It's more like, I mean, he's a wannabe, if anything else, you know.
Do we know, can we follow individual agents? Do we know where Yousef and Hussein went next?
No, I mean, I'd love to know that. I mean, I would bet that they have worked other cases, you know, but it's impossible to know who they are.
Right. Do you see an evolution of the entrapment defense or sort of allowed evidence presented?
Not really. I mean, so the most recent entrapment case actually trial happened here. It was Sammy Osmakosh in Tampa. And he was found guilty. You know, I mean, in that case, it was still kind of the same issues where it was like they had trouble proving, you know, that he wasn't predisposed. They had trouble kind of excluding a lot of the evidence. I mean, I think we're seeing fewer cases go to trial, you know, in part because I think people are seeing cases like Muhammad's and realizing, like, hey, if you've got a Muslim name and you're charged with terrorism, it's a hard case to beat, you know. And I think that in the U.S., I mean, and so certainly I think it's worth noting, too, like, there has been this evolution in the sting, and the U.S. government realizes what plays really well, and one of the things that plays really well is, like, hey, you've got a bomb, or you've got a Stinger missile. And so they're always, like, introducing these, like, things that are just kind of overwhelming to the jury.
Do you see a new movement to step back from the JTTF from local municipalities?
It seems that way post-Trump, right? Like, San Francisco pulled out. Portland was one of the holdouts for a long time, right? Are they?
They were in, and then an ex-police chief, Tom Potter, pulled out because he couldn't get security clearance. He said, well, if I can't supervise my officers, there's no way.
I see. So Portland was out pre-Trump, right?
Portland was out pre-Muhammad.
Pre-Muhammad, okay.
After the scare.
That's right, and there was, I remember this, that's right, and there was, like, some people had theorized that part of this was to push Portland back into the JTTF, right? Yeah.
The mayor didn't know about it. Commissioner Saltzman, the next day, introduced a resolution to join the Joint Terrorism Task Force.
Right. Immediately after the bombing, or supposed bombing, yeah.
Anything interesting in the new Intercept docs that's related to these kind of cases?
Not yet, and nothing I know of. You know, not all of them have been released, and I don't have access to the full archive. I mean, what I can do is I usually ask them to send, to keyword search it. Part of it, I have been interested in parallel construction. I was hoping that the NSA documents would show that, like, perhaps what happened with Muhammad is somehow documented in the NSA documents, right, or related to the FISA. And so far, as far as I know, there hasn't been any proof of that yet, you know. You know, there's been confirmation that's been reported about the use of FISA by the DEA on the border, and so what they'll do is they'll, like, using FISA evidence will target, like, drug dealers on the Mexican side, and they'll know who's shipping drugs across, and then they'll let them across the border, and they'll know what car it is because of the intercepts, but when they go to arrest them, they'll be like, oh, your taillight was out, and then, you know, we smelled drugs and got them, even though the real evidence was that they intercepted communications that, you know, while kind of legal for counterintelligence reasons, can't be used as evidence in a criminal court, and so they just manufacture the predicate by saying, like, the taillight was out kind of thing.
Does the FBI monitor you?
I don't know, you know, I mean, I'm not, I've had no reason to, like, to think that, right? Like, I mean, other than, like everyone, like, sometimes, like, my phone makes ticking noises and you joke, like, oh, there's totally listening to us right now. But I don't know. I mean, I like to think, I suspect to some degree they can, right? Just like they can to everyone, right? Because, like, all of my communications are picked up in 702, as are yours, and so they could always go back and say, like, hey, let's see who Joe was talking to this time last year. Let's see who Trevor was talking to you this time last year. And, you know, and the irony is, like, that's what happened to Mike Flynn, right, when he talked to Kislyak. And, like, now everyone's like, I can't believe they invade people's privacy. Like, well, they've been doing this for years. So I think it's possible. I mean, I think, like, I've communicated online as well as by phone with people who are close to other people who've done terrible things, right? And so, you know, in the when they draw, like, the social networks, I mean, at times I may have come up in other investigations. I've always kind of, like, up until the Trump presidency, had a feeling, like, there was still enough respect for the press that they wouldn't, like, overly abuse spying on journalists. With Trump, I don't know, you know, it kind of makes me wonder sometimes, you know, I do use Signal and encryption as much as I can, you know, just out of an abundance of caution, and I think most people, including journalists, should, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Just as I was getting off 275, it's a big billboard, FBI wanted, I don't remember the gentleman's name, call the FBI.
No, really?
Would you?
Would I call the FBI? Yeah, I mean, I'm like, you know, if I saw, like, if there was, like, a dangerous person, right, who's, like, wanted by the FBI, like, broke out of prison and, or whatever, and I see something that I think is a crime, like, I would still report to the FBI. I mean, I think, you know, I don't view the FBI as this monolithic agency that's out to screw people, right? Like, they do really good work as well as very questionable work, like the sting operation. So I definitely would, you know, if I saw a crime, I would definitely report it.
You would kind of want to know what it's about before you call them.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, but at the same time, I'm not going to be, like, a tool for the FBI. Like, if somebody with, like, an AK-47, like, starts, like, marching through my front yard, I'm going to call the cops and be like, maybe you should call the ATF and the FBI. But, like, if I'm reporting on something, I'm not going to, like, you know, provide information to the FBI.
Last question is called, what's the good news, Trevor?
The good news. What is the good news? I'd like to think that people are more aware of what's going on about this stuff now, right? Like, I feel like I've been writing about things now for, what, 6 or 7 years, and, like, when I started to write about it, I think there wasn't really a recognition that this was a problem. There also was this feeling like,